Welcome to Better Words, a podcast for readers who want to know the stories behind the pages.
We're your hosts, Caitlin and Michelle, two book nerds who bring you in-depth conversations about writing and publishing from those on the inside.
Basically, we're just here to talk about books.
We're so glad you're joining us.
Hello, welcome back to Better Words. Thanks for joining us again for another new episode. How are you, Caitlin?
I'm good. I'm so excited to talk about my recommendation today, actually. I'm actually just going to jump straight into it.
Go for it.
It was so funny. I said that and then I was like, oh, and I'll give like a preamble or something to my recommendation, but I don't know how to do that. I'm just going to tell you about it. So I actually mentioned this book in our 2023 wrap-up episode as one of my, like, 2024 picks, like, on my TBR, books that I was looking forward to. So it is So Fetch, The Making of Mean Girls and Why We're Still So Obsessed with It by Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. And as the title says, it is all about Mean Girls and kind of the phenomenon it became and like the stay power of Mean Girls and all the sort of ins and outs of making it. So Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong has written a bunch of books in this area. I've read another book that she's written called Sex and the City and Us, which similarly is all about Sex and the City and kind of the cultural impact that that show had. And I think she's also written one about Seinfeld and maybe something else. But this book is like, on the back it says like, get in loser, we're going back to 2004. And it's all these things about all of the pieces that kind of came together to make this movie. Like, oh, I mean, this is kind of like a great fun fact in this book. If you're someone who likes behind the scenes of movies and TV shows and this kind of industry, or, you know, is a fan of Tina Fey or Lindsay Lohan or Rachel McAdams or whatever, all of this, like, intel, so good. But the person who played Glenn Coco, so of the infamous, All Four For You, Glenn Coco, You Go, Glenn Coco, which also I think there was a, like, when people were doing the rounds of the media for the Mean Girls, the musical, the movie, I think Tina Fey said she named Glenn Coco after, like, a friend of her brother's or something like that, and it's spelled differently, but she's like, yeah, whoops, I, like, ruined his life by naming this character him. When they were filming that scene, like, that day on set, there was a local, because they filmed the movie in Toronto, in Canada, as many American things are filmed. And there was a local actor who had auditioned for a few things and didn't get a role or, like, get cast in this movie, but knew heaps of people on it and I think was filming something nearby. And he just kind of went over to say hi. And the director recognized him. And was like, great, like, let's put you in this scene, come here. And, like, they, like, wardrobe got him, like, an extra hoodie or something. This actor who played him says, I think the director thought I was, like, an extra. And he was like, oh, great, we'll bump you up, like, to this, like, featured extra kind of thing. But he actually was not supposed to be there and was not cast in the movie. But just, like, kind of for fun, not thinking too much of it. It's just a thing that films here, this isn't going to be any different than anything else I've been an extra in or been a background actor in. And so he sat there in front of Lindsay Lohan and was like, here you go, Glenn Coco. And now, like, he gets recognized all the time. And that was, like, a really interesting thing with this book, is that because there are so many iconic little characters and iconic lines, like, it's not just, it actually is hardly even, say, Regina George or Katie Heron. Like, we're not really quoting their lines. We're quoting, like, all of these other lines. Yeah. Like,
yeah,
the actress who played the salesperson at the shop when they're buying their prom dresses, and she goes, you could try Sears. She's like, cannot escape it. She is not even an actor now, and, like, her own employees, like, quote that back to her. Anyway, it's just incredible. It covers the making of the movie and kind of how it, against all the odds, actually was, like, really, really successful. And in the landscape of movies that were coming out at the time, like, to not, because Lindsay Lohan was in Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen, the same year, and so they didn't want to clash with that. They didn't want to clash with, I think, Princess Diaries, suddenly 30 or 13 going on 30. Depends where you are, how it's known. You know,
so
all of these.
Weird to think that all those movies came out at the same time. They're so iconic.
I know. And even to think,
why
that...
is it that there are just some, like, there are just some time periods where you have a bunch of things that come out that it
and
seems
it's just
do
like
really well,
magic.
Like, because also Shrek 2004 as well. Like, there's so many things.
Yeah,
that
so many things
came
in that
out
year. But
in that year,
also one that I always found fascinating, and I didn't actually know too much about the logistics of it necessarily, is that Rachel McAdams had filmed The Notebook before getting cast in Mean Girls. They came out around the same in the same year. I don't know how far apart necessarily. She had filmed that already. Was like had you know been getting a few parts, but like wasn't super, super A-list like she is now, obviously. Kind of by chance, auditioning for different things and having filmed that project and then getting this project in the same year, she proved she could do drama and comedy really, really well and is actually a pretty rare example. She's continued to do both. Like, she's been in really, really serious movies and, like, really, really funny movies. And, like, kind of reading that, I was like, oh, my God, mind blown. Rachel McAdams actually straddles both really well. She's not like, you can maybe think of some other actors who've made the leap in like a surprising way or something, or like have gone back and forth but not at the same time, whereas like she kind of continues. She'll be in Spotlight and then she'll be in like Game Night, you know, like it's
goes back and forth. I never really thought of that, but
it's fascinating,
so
isn't it
true.
But it's just kind of like she, if The Notebook had come out already, she never would have been cast in Mean Girls. They wouldn't have, they would have been like, oh, that girl, she can't be Regina George. They never would, like, they wouldn't have seen her. It's absolutely insane.
That's,
I mean,
crazy.
Anyone who, I mean, you know, and anyone who knows me and listens to our podcast regularly is like, oh, Caitlin, another behind the scenes of like TV and movies related wreck. I listen to these podcasts, I read these books, but Mean Girls really is something else, and it's so fascinating to read this book and think about it. And every time like a new iconic line or a character, you're like, oh yeah, I love that line, like the girl who got to say, I have a heavy flow and a wide set vagina. Like that almost didn't make it through because they were like trying to get a PG rating as opposed to an R rating, and Tina Fey had to fight for it and was like, I'm sorry, is vagina a bad word? Fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating to like,
So yes, please read this book if you're a fan of anything in this realm. It's fantastic. I did get a copy through work.
Amazing.
It's published by HarperCollins, but I probably would have bought it anyway.
Yeah, cool. And you ticked one off, you're like, I'm so excited for, and it was just as good as you thought it was going to be.
I did. I actually read it.
Excellent.
What have you read this week, Michelle? What have you read recently?
Well, I haven't read it this week. I finished it this week after starting it in January, which I know is kind of ridiculous, but
that happens, though.
You know, I read multiple books. I think it's fascinating to talk about people's reading habits, and you know, we might do that in a different episode, but basically it's quite a big book. It's like 540 pages basically, so it's a big chunky book. It's beautiful, but it's like quite short chapters and stuff, and it's split into like five acts, so I did feel like I could stop at various points, and we just got busy with stuff for the podcast, but also because it's the kind of style of writing it is, I didn't want to rush it. And I've really enjoyed dipping back into it. So it is called The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn, and it's actually her debut novel, and it's really kind of surprising and amazing that it's a debut. It's beautiful. Gave me like very Downton Abbey vibes, like the later seasons of Downton Abbey, because it starts in the 1920s, or sorry, 1919. So we sort of end of the Second World War, but right through to the end, sorry, end of the First World War right through to the end of the Second World War. And it is basically the story of an old English manor house. It's sort of described as this crumbling manor by the sea. It's the story of three children who grow up there, the adventures they create for themselves while the grown-ups entertain endless party guests, the worlds they imagine from books that aren't supposed to be read, and the lessons they learn from eavesdropping through oak-paneled doors. This is a story of a whale that washes up on a beach whose bones are claimed by a 12-year-old girl with big ambitions and an even bigger imagination, an unwanted orphan who grows into an unmarriageable young woman, chafing under the confines of her traditional upbringing and fiercely determined to do things differently. So basically they turn the whale and the whale bones into a theatre, and as children they start sort of putting on, and through their teenage years start putting on plays there. And, you know, one of the children, Digby, loves being an actor. Christabel, who is the fierce and brave 12-year-old girl, is the one who sort of directs everything. She has the big vision. And Flossie in the middle is sort of going along with everything, but really sort of never really knows who she is because she's always sort of the sidekick to the other two. And it basically follows them into adulthood and into the Second World War as they grow up, and sort of start to each find themselves in, you know, this crazy situation that they're in of the world at war. So Digby goes off to fight and very luckily like gets back, but then goes into sort of secret work. And Christabel is just like, I want to do that too. So she starts doing like secrets, basically sort of becomes spies and are sort of working for the English government in the French Resistance, which ties in very nicely. I think one of the reasons I felt compelled to pick it back up again from, I'd sort of got to the start of the Second World War in it, and you know that Second World War stuff is like something I'm interested in. I think the thing that sort of pushed me to read, like to really sit down and read the last 200 or 50 pages last week to really sort of be like, okay, I'm going to finish this, is a television show called The New Look, which I'm going to recommend more in detail in our end of month Substack. Links in the show notes.
Ooh, so what a little tease.
If you want to learn more about that. I know. but it is basically, it is sort of partly about the French Resistance as well. So then when I sort of was like, I'm going to just read it. I've been reading a couple of chapters every few weeks, and then I sort of realized where it was going, and I was like, oh, like it's, I don't know. It was just very fresh in my mind, and you know, I'm a very visual reader. So it was all sort of fresh in my mind, and I was like, I'm just going to go for it. And then obviously you get to a tipping point in the book where you're like,
yeah,
I really need to know what happens. And then I just kept going.
I think that happens with big books. You kind of, you go through and somewhere towards the end, like the end always goes faster. You're like so sunk in by that point that, you just seem to fly through that. Like, the last 250 pages, as you say, like so much quicker.
Which I think that always is the equivalent of like a book that you and I would usually read in a week anyway. And I was just kind of like, oh, instead of starting something new, I'm just going to make this my mission to read and finish for my recommendation this week. But yeah, I started it on the 4th of January. So it took me quite a while, but, you know, dipping in and out. And as I say, like the chapters are sort of short. There's lots of different things. It sort of switches perspective a lot between the three children, and then they'll bring in letters. So the start of like the Second World War, a lot of that scene setting is letters between Christabel and Digby during their training and stuff, things that they write to each other. Flossie's at home and, you know, there'll be letters that she doesn't send but writes. And so you're getting all these sorts of extra things as well as just the normal story. And it's just quite interesting like that. And just other little snippets and stuff. And I really enjoyed that. And I'm like so impressed that it's her debut, because it's really beautiful writing, and it's that sort of, I think anyone who enjoys an epic family story, if you sort of like Downton Abbey and the sort of the way that you sort of know what's happening with all the different members of the family, it's not as intense as that because it really does focus on the three children, but still, you know what happens with their mother, and you know all the stuff that's happening, and it does feel like this epic family story, and it is set over like 25 years, so you do get this sort of
it sounds
really
quite
nice portrait of
like
a family,
epic and sweeping I don't know. I always want to say sweeping. Yeah. With like a big family size.
Sweeping epic. Yeah. But I do think if you know you enjoy those kinds of books, this is probably one that I think over here maybe was quite big, but might not be. I still think feels like a sort of a niche title. Like it might not be huge on everyone's radar. I think it was one of our fiction picks of the month at Waterstones before I started working there, which is why I bought it, because my now colleague Beth loved it and recommended it. And she said something about like they build this theatre, Second World. And I was like, okay. And she's like, Second World War. I was like, great, I'm sold. I'd love that. And yeah, finally was like, yep, I'm going to read it. And, you know, the quotes are kind of quite accurate. The blurbs on this is like, it feels like a much loved book, even if you're reading it for the first time. And it does have that sort of comforting, it's hard to put into words really, but it is that sort of
warm
drama, love, grief, comedy, beautiful, warm story. And if that sounds like something you like, then you're gonna love this. So yeah, that's The Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn.
Wonderful.
I know. And finally ticked a big chunky book off my list, so that's good.
Yeah, look at that. A lot of ticking happening this week. That's excellent.
It's nice, hey. So I'm so excited to sort of throw to this interview that we're doing, because as soon as we finished recording it, I was like, I need to read this book again. Like, it just made me so excited to reread this book. So I'm really excited that this week we are sharing an interview with Lottie Hazel about her debut novel, Piglet.
Enjoy.
Our guest today is a contemporary literary scholar, a board game designer, and writer who lives in Warwickshire. She holds a PhD in creative writing, and her research considers food writing in the 21st century. Today, we are discussing her debut novel, a delicious story about a woman called Piglet. Welcome to the podcast, Lottie Hazel.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I worry we're going to make a lot of food puns in this because I was like, I just want to be like, yeah, let's, I don't even know what I was going to say now, but I feel like I thought of a food pun, said the thing about food puns, and now I've forgotten it. But
it's unavoidable. It will happen. It's almost inevitable.
Yeah, we will come across another one.
I seriously think, though, I was describing this story to people as I was reading it, because I'm a bookseller, and so I was telling some of my colleagues who were also reading it, and I was like, the writing is, like, delectable. Like, I want to use food terms to describe your writing. It is so sumptuous and delectable, and I just couldn't get enough. I devoured it. Like, it's just all the food words, I think,
yes,
accurately.
Devoured. That's a classic food one that people always use for books, isn't it? Devoured.
But I really did, like, I just, once I started, I couldn't stop. Yeah, it's such a good book. And also the cover is so alluring with those, like, gorgeous donuts squashed together. Like, it's just, it's so good. Anyway,
actually, can we, before we talk about the book, can we take a moment and talk about the cover? Because I, for some, like, we've been dealing with, you know, your UK publisher and everything, obviously, Lottie, and I've seen Michelle's copy and, you know, all these different things and in our planning docs and stuff. And then today I was like, you know, preparing and everything, and the Australian cover has an apple on it.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it's different.
I need to take a moment to look up what the Australian... I didn't
realise
we had a third
cover. Yeah,
Google
the Australian cover, Michelle. Yeah, because the Australian cover has like a cut, like a half a green apple, I think it was, and it's got like a fork or a spoon or something in it, which when I looked at, if I hadn't seen the other covers, in the Australian market of this like literary kind of books, you know, slightly simple but intriguing cover design, I'm like, oh, it totally is going to fit on Australian bookshelves and look really intriguing.
It's beautiful,
but it is,
but
so
I don't
different.
I don't want to eat that.
Yeah, and I think
yes, the UK cover is very alluring. Yes, the covers it's such an interesting project for this book because I think it's really hard to capture the cover because, or that the intent of the book in the cover without making it overly foodie and being like, this is a food, like writing memoir, or like, or leaning too much into, I suppose, the tropes of the wedding and that kind of thing. So
yeah,
the Australian cover is actually an earlier version of the UK cover. That the Australians then loved, and they decided to keep that version, and then the British cover went with the donuts in the end. So it's fascinating having these little, yeah, the differences across the markets.
It's amazing.
So fascinating. It's so rare. We normally just kind of import them, but also the market is a bit more similar to the US. Like, I mean, to the UK. The US is more different.
I wondered if it's because that cover, the Apple cover, had got so far, it was pretty much done. So I guess they had the choice of two completely finished covers. There was no Maybe. Other work to do. But it is fascinating to think why the Australians were particularly partial to the Apple. But
It is. Yeah. Because why? Like, we like donuts. Like, I don't know. It's so
I think
odd.
There's kind of like a more... vicious intensity about the apple, whereas the donuts feel a bit more like foreboding. I suppose there's a kind of different vibe.
Yeah, it's a slightly
this is what
different
we tell
feeling.
Each other in the covers meeting.
Sorry, this is a detour straight away in the conversation.
I know, I love this detour. I'm totally happy to be here with you both.
Anyway, why don't we get back on the road of can you actually tell us what Piglet is about? Because we've alluded to all this stuff and people might be like, what's it about?
Yeah. Is it apples?
Yeah, no, start at the beginning, please.
Yeah. So I describe Piglet as a story of appetite and aspiration, and it centres on our protagonist Piglet in the weeks before her wedding. And a few days before she's due to be married, her fiancé, Kit, confesses this terrible truth to her that threatens to shatter the very carefully curated identity she's shaped for them both. And the novel follows her in the countdown to the wedding, and we see her try to process this truth mostly through the lens of food, which is how she really assesses value in other people and how she perceives herself, and it culminates in their kind of catastrophic wedding.
It is so interesting, this book, and there's so many things, like, as I was reading, like, there's so many things. I'm really excited to reread it because I do think there's so much to sort of discuss. I think it'd be a great book club book as well when I'm thinking, like, you know, all the things that you can talk about. But you mentioned their aspiration, and I think that's something I'd sort of forgotten because I sort of have questions here for you about, like, relationships and, like, in terms of the family aspect and stuff. But you're right, there's so much. Of course you're right, it's your book. But there's so much in there about this life that Piglet is trying to build. And we should say as well, Piglet is a nickname from childhood that's stuck. And actually one of the moments that really made me sort of pause when reading as I was racing towards the end is when you reveal what her actual name is. And I was like, you know, just that moment of,
Yeah, those moments are so good, aren't they?
But I think there is this sort of this idea of this curated life, this sort of almost like Pinterest board life that she's building, this house. They've moved into this house that they've bought, and she really delights in, I mean, I think it's like one of the opening scene, isn't it, of like creating these dinners for her friends. And I could just imagine her, she is a cookbook editor, so I could just imagine her with, like, you know, the Ottolenghi cookbooks and all that sort of stuff. The very aspirational things that you sort of see I see in our bookshop sometimes and think, gosh, that's gorgeous, but would I ever actually use that for more than one recipe and stuff? But that is the life she's building. And then the longer we go, the more that we learn about her life and where she's come from, which coincidentally is quite near where I live now, you sort of understand maybe that she's running away and trying to build this new life that is, yeah, just a whole different level from what she's used to and what she's grown up with, and the, you know, sort of two up, two down, terrace house vibe of where she grew up.
I think what you were saying about how, when you mentioned the family relationships at the beginning, for me, the aspiration is so connected to that because Piglet's aspiration is so closely linked to her formative relationships. And I think that the familial and where we end up seeing her is all connected for me. But I think when we meet her, Piglet is very much someone who is concerned of how she's perceived and the perception of the self. So what you're saying about how she spreads out her dinner party and the cookbooks on her shelf, they all contribute to her sense of value and her self-worth.
Yeah, it's kind of that feeling of, you know, like we would all love to make such a beautiful dinner party and actually, yeah, use the cookbooks. I own cookbooks, I never open them.
They look so good though, so in a way it's kind of like the spines are lovely.
You can tell which ones we use regularly And I'm going to say them because actually, you know, like obviously food is a big part of this book, but I did open up one the other day and I was like, oh, you can tell which one our favorite recipe is because it's got food and stuff all over it from that. So we, just if anyone wants ones that you do actually use all the time, I regularly meal plan from Gordon Ramsay's Ramsay in 10. And that is the one that I opened up the other day and I was looking at some of the pasta dishes. And I know pasta is one of your favourites, Lottie.
Yes.
And it's got like speckles of stuff on it. And Mary Berry's Simple Comfort.
There is something about the well-loved cookbook as well. Like I think like a, I don't know, Common Sense Cookery or Central Cook, something like that. Like one of those like old classic ones that my mum had. But like the cinnamon tea cake that she made all the time was on page 254. And I can still tell you that, you know, so.
Oh, I love that detail.
Yeah, I did like, think, I was like, yeah, that is how cookbooks are meant to be, aren't they? You're meant to use them and it sort of does mark your enjoyment of them.
I think splattered cookbooks are the best. Like when people send me pictures of their proofs and there's like grease thumbed like pages, I was like, this is the highest compliment.
Oh,
you're eating
compliment.
And reading, like I love that.
That is an amazing compliment. Are you a cookbook collector? Because obviously, as we mentioned just before, the character Piglet is a cookbook editor in the story, so that is a part of how food is a big thing obviously in this novel, but that's one way that food is mentioned and everything. So
I have a serious problem. And I have, like you, a kind of selection of cookbooks in my daily repertoire of like, these are the ones that I plan from and that I like to cook from regularly. But I have so many where it's like, I don't think that I would really ever want to move house because the prospect of packing them is like, we'll just live here forever, I think. I think we'll stay.
And they are heavy.
They are heavy. Yeah.
They are like, yes, the, and like the heavy. Big, like nice cookbooks as well. Like, again, I work in publishing. Carrying a box of 10 of them is like 10 kilos. They're so big and heavy.
Yeah, it's no joke.
Yeah.
What are some of your go-to ones about them. So that I can have an excuse to buy more?
I love the Roasting Sin series by Rukmini Iyer. I don't know if you've come, I'm sure you have come across it. They're massive in the UK at least, which I love because they're so easy. And just anything that I can get in the oven that's delicious, like on a weeknight, is amazing. Mm. I do like Ottolenghi cookbooks. They are lovely. And I particularly like, oh, what was the recent one? Flavour, which is just wonderful. Like, it's more project cooking. Like, I did try and do a couple of, like, weeknight dishes from there, and I was like, this is not for the weeknight. This is for the weekend. But still lovely. A new one that I have, it's The Farm Table by Julius Roberts, which is absolutely gorgeous, really wonderful food writing. And like one of those books where it's like, I want to make every recipe, and most of them look, if they're longer recipes, they still don't look too, you know, intricate and like a massive demand on time. My bugbear is if you have a recipe and I'm using like more than 2 pans, like it has to be like worth a plus 2 pan meal. Like if it's a lot of washing up, then it's kind of like, eh.
Yeah. Anyway, back to the novel again. We're getting sidetracked by the food. And I can cut this question if you feel like it's a spoiler, Lottie. And I was really unsure of how to ask you this and whether you consider it a spoiler. But I personally saw, before I read the book and went into the novel, knowing that we would never find out what Kit confesses to Piglet. I think that really enhanced the experience for me. Can you explain to us a little bit more, like, why you did it? You sort of wanted to approach the whole revelation thing in this way? Because it has, I think, kind of split readers a little bit.
Yeah, it's been such a fascinating thing to have the book in the world and have readers' response to that. And it makes me think about how different the reading experience would be if you knew about whether or not we find out or whether you don't. I think you're right, it would change your kind of expectations. But I kind of had two answers for this. So the first is that belongs to Piglet and that I was interested in telling a story that was about her and about this woman trying to find a way to reclaim some power. And she's doing that mostly through the use of her body. And I think that to focus overly on Kit's confessional content feels like that detracts from that in some way, and I wasn't really interested. Whatever he's done, it threatens what she has built for herself, and it could be anything. It doesn't really matter to me. And the second reason,
and whatever it is, would probably make the book about something else as well.
I was talking to someone the other day about how if I had labelled what he'd done, it then becomes an exercise of judgment of her in the end. Do we agree with her actions and the extremity or not of taking them, rather than an assessment of the whole book? And I think that I hadn't really even properly considered that to label it would be to invite that judgment, and I'm pleased that I didn't. But from my perspective, I'm interested in the collaboration that I can have with each reader and how each reader makes a slightly different book, how they imagine a slightly different story. And I'm fascinated by the potential of the blank space that I leave that then is filled each time with a different mind and the different theories, even if they are varying only very slightly. I think that is just such an interesting thing to do, in my very humble opinion. And I mean an interesting thing to do from my perspective as the writer, not as it's a, you know, very interesting book. But yeah, I'm fascinated by that potential collaboration. And also the breaking of the contract between the author and the reader, because that's kind of what I'm doing. I've not delivered in the way that you might expect. And I kind of am fascinated by all the emotions that elicits as well.
Ooh, I'm so glad I did ask it, because I was like, I don't know if you're going to be like, no, that's, you know, people don't, like, I just wasn't sure, like,
that's
what's
a huge
spoiler,
twist.
What's a not. Yeah.
I have a question then, and this can be a no further questions, simple yes or no. Do you know what that confession is and you just decided not to tell us, or was that still not important?
I felt like, when I was writing, I felt like one of the guests at the wedding, just like peering around being like, do you think it was this? Like, it probably was this because, you know, he's that kind of person, or whatever it was. But I didn't feel like I had a real sense of truth in a universal way. And there are a couple of earlier drafts of the book where I experimented with writing in one of my theories, or a few of them in different drafts. And when I was editing that, I was like, this isn't better for me suggesting what it could be. Is actually, I think it detracts from it hugely.
Yeah.
So I only had theories along with everyone else. And I have, one of the great joys of this book has been
hearing
people's theories.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. I love that, though, because it's like, none of us know. Because again, as we said before, it's not about him, it's about her. So.
And I feel, in a way, like, I don't really feel like I know all of Piglet's motivations. Like, I have an idea what drives her, but she doesn't feel like she belongs to me in the sense that I have autonomy over her. Yeah, I don't feel like I'm in their internal lives in the same way that I feel like I would be in my own, if that makes sense.
Yeah, oh my gosh, that's fascinating. I love hearing authors talking about their characters and the different ways that they approach them as well. I mean, that's why we love doing this podcast, isn't it, Caitlin?
Yeah, because everyone has different answers. Okay, more on writing. So again, we're probably a bit into food territory here, but we'll try and stay focused. Reading Piglet really does, you know, it's like Michelle was saying before, it's like, oh, it's like scrumptious and all this thing, like that sort of addictive feeling. Didn't you say, oh my gosh, you said also that Liz read it in like a day.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, Michelle?
Yeah.
Like this really quick, addictive feeling. Was that how it felt to write the book, or did that take work to kind of create that pace and that force throughout the book?
No, that took work. That was the work, I think. Yeah, the first draft was like just rubbish. It was like what I call the shit draft. And editing it was like shedding a skin. And only in the edit did that propulsion really present itself as being like, this is what this is supposed to be, and this is how the book is supposed to, this is the energy, which felt so obvious in the edit, like, because of course the countdown is happening, it has a natural sense of claustrophobia and, you know, an incoming
and that
drumming
tension
of,
I think energy is a really good word as well, actually.
But no, that took work.
I also find it so fascinating when some people can say, oh my god, you know, I wrote the book so quickly, it just like flew out of me and everything like that. And but yeah, to craft that also is, yes, it's worth,
yeah, fully own that, yeah.
The writing, I think, is actually quite nice. Like the first draft writing, it's like, for me, and anyway, this for Piglet, was let's get words on the page and let's move quite quickly. But then the words on the page aren't very good. it's great, we've written it, we've written at speed.
Yeah.
But we haven't, at that point, I haven't created something that was really worthy of anyone reading but myself. So, the edit is, I think, for me anyway, that's where it's like, this is the job of writing.
I agree. Yeah. Because you can't get to the magic without actually doing the editing. You need to edit the shit stuff.
Well, can you? This is my question. It's like, can you actually do that? Like, I'm interested in my next lot of writing. I'm trying to write more consciously the first time round, but then it's slower. So I'm like, is it just the same amount of time in the end? What's better, to write quickly and then edit, or to write slowly and then edit less? I don't know.
I think it probably is down to personal preference.
This is, again, why we love talking to different authors, because everybody has different processes and different things that they enjoy. So, again, returning to the novel. So we talked a little bit about family before and obviously how it's
our
all...
our theme of the day.
Returning to the novel.
Yeah.
How it's all sort of interconnected. A couple of the sort of key relationships in Pignett's life, apart from obviously her fiancé, her in-laws, and that contrast with the relationship she has with her sister and her parents. And we start to see that like really uncomfortable shift and change, but also some really like unexpectedly nice ways that changes as well. I'm thinking particularly with her sister. I know that you mentioned before this all links back with like the life that Piglet is trying to build, but how for you does this all link in with food and desire as well? Because I know that sort of obviously relates to your academic work as well, looking at how food and desire is sort of written in modern novels.
Yeah, I think specifically for Piglet, I think the relationship with Franny is kind of key there. The way that she gets her nickname, and that being a kind of tender act and something that's wrapped up not in her personal desire but in their relationship and her different desire to kind of try and keep her sister safe, even if that's misguided in how she goes about that. I think that's all really interlinked, but I think that food, like family, has such formative power, and food and the family is almost like a kind of a real heady collision of things, in that it can have such power to communicate what the familial structures are. So the viennese that they eat and what that represents in their family, and then what that represents for Piglet, I think that says so much. I just think that food is such a useful shorthand in that, in that regard. And then Piglet's desire at one time to eat that kind of food and then not. Again, I think it's just says so very much without having to say much at all. So I think that's all deeply connected.
It's, I guess, too, because they are so closely linked, and I didn't really think about it until you said it just then, but, like, obviously our family is in most cases, the people who introduce us to food, and our kind of relationship with food is formed by how our parents feed us and, you know, our relationships with certain things develop, you know, as children, either at the dinner table or in front of the TV, or what you're eating, and that idea of comfort food as well, that harks back to maybe some childhood foods and stuff, like, I'm sure we all still have them. But yeah, I guess it really is like the place where we start is being fed by our parents, and therefore of course it's interlinked.
Yes, yeah, and, you know, kind of more than just the sense of the nourishing the physical self, but the emotional self and the shaping of that.
God, it's such a fascinating topic. So this is your area of academic research, like related to this, right? Mm. So how did, maybe you need to tell us a little bit about your academic research, and maybe how then that transformed into be a novel.
Yeah, my academic preoccupations are specifically about food-centered fiction, which I kind of loosely define as any fiction that uses food in a thematic way, and how that can intersect with disclosure. And often that covers what would maybe be quoted as domestic novels. But the way Piglet came about from that was I was looking at how novels could provide senses of satisfaction in different ways, and I was specifically interested in if a novel centres on a confession, but confessional content is withheld, are there other ways in which satisfaction can be offered, food writing being one? And then just a kind of larger, more kind of holistic piece about, does it matter if we feel satisfied as readers at the end of the book? Like, I never want to be satisfied.
Yeah.
I don't want to feel things are wrapped up neatly. That would make me dissatisfied. So I was interested in the whole kind of cyclical satisfaction cycle, obviously.
Oh my god, that is like a big question all on itself, isn't it? Mm. It's like, do you want to be like the story to be wrapped up and like, or not? And like, there'd be all kind of different examples of this, even when we think about genre fiction. Like, sometimes at the end of like a romance or a rom-com where I should know what I'm getting myself into, then if at the end they like seemingly get engaged really fast or something, or there's like an epilogue where they're married or something, I'm a bit like, ugh, like I didn't need that,
yeah.
You know? Whereas in the same way, like, you know, if you read like a crime novel or something, but at the end of it, you don't know what happened or who did it, you'd be like, well, what was the point? Yeah. Like yeah, the mystery's not solved.
Yeah. I read a book just the other day and, you know, that last chapter throws into question everything that's been before. I mean, I love something like that. Maybe that's why I loved your book so much, that
yeah,
I love
thinking really
about these things after.
But again, it can depend on the type of book and the genre and that kind of thing as well.
Also, I think it's the expectation that the reader's being set up with, which is why covers are so important.
Yeah.
Like I think if the Piglet cover looked like it was going to be a kind of like, will they, won't they get married cover, at the end you'd be like, what was this? Like, I've been duped.
yeah,
that's wonderful. So did Piglet start out as part of your PhD then, or was it separate?
Yes, so there is a version of Piglet in the PhD that's shorter and kind of more extracted and a little bit more experimental in places, but yeah, so that's where a version is, and then I was writing the version for submission kind of at the same time, which was really fun.
Ooh, do you mean fun like sarcastic? Like, was
going
that
to be
hard?
The same.
That must have been so hard.
Oh, no. It was nice. It was nice. It kind of felt like both pieces of work were feeding each other. So I am really terrible at doing multiple projects at once. I'm very monogamous to creative pursuits. So it was really nice to have two things that were symbiotic, because it felt productive, but in a good way.
Yeah. Productive to be for both to be
yes,
working on
exactly.
either kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. And to be creating two very similar pieces that actually were different and for different intents.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Well.
Yes, because there are some decisions in the thesis version of Piglet that I decided to remove. That were like tiny, but it was interesting to think about different audiences in the writing. But I suppose that's the case for all formats, I am thinking about the reader at the end.
Yeah, definitely. And that, I think, comes back to that idea of the contract that you're setting up with the reader and what you're offering them, isn't it? Like, you do have to think about the reader in some sense, if not when
yes.
you first conceive of the story, then when you're editing.
Yes, and that's why I love to hear that people read it in a day, because I feel like I'm so pleased that people have felt that they wanted to turn the page. Like, that to me is the most important thing.
Oh, good. I'm always pleased when writers say that, because we obviously know how much work goes into a book. So, you know, you spend years writing it and editing it and all these things, and then we're like, oh, I read it in a day. All your hard work. I just read it in a day.
No, I love that. I love that, because it's like I think that is such a compliment. And I think to me, that feels like, well, that's been a success. Someone's wanted to keep reading. Like, when I edit, I'm looking for the times where I'm like, oh, I'm going to get a cup of tea, or I'm going to go and for a walk. Like, when am I bored by my own story? Because if I am, do I need to edit further here?
Wow, very hard on yourself there.
Yeah, there'll be no drinks. No movement, just reading.
Obviously, we've talked a lot about food as well. Just to sort of wrap up talking about the content of the novel specifically, how did you sort of capture the experiences of writing and eating? Because they're so real. And also, I texted friends. Mm. I texted my friend who had read it, and I texted other people who I knew were reading it. And I was like, I have never, ever been so invested in someone making a croque en bouche. I probably say it wrong because I'm, you know, not
no,
posh. Like, I'm like Piglet's sisters. I'm like, when she was like, it's called this, I'm like, ah, ha, ha, that's how I feel. But yeah, I've never been so invested in that. I could not. I was like, what's going to happen?
Yeah, I'm oddly proud of the infusion of tension into pastry. I feel like, you know, that feels like an accomplishment. But I, in a very tongue-in-cheek way, say that I method wrote the book because I cooked all of the recipes that Piglet makes, including the croque en bouche, and some of the failures in that part of the book are inspired by my own, because that is a hard, hard recipe.
Yes, pastry is difficult. Desserts can be so complex. That's
yes.
amazing. You baked your way through the book.
I was trying to get a sense of kind of like of empathy with Piglet and find a way of really inhabiting her sensorial self. And so that felt like the obvious way to do it was to cook and eat alongside her.
So method. So then I guess we'll jump back a bit. So you were writing the book alongside your thesis. So then can you take us through sort of your journey to publication? Like, how did that process work for you?
So I had kind of really intently targeted the agent that I wanted to work with, Harriet Moore, who is just
fantastic.
Excellent. Yes. And I try and tell the story in a way that makes me not sound like a serial killer or a sociopath. But I had been looking at the books that she'd been agenting, and I just felt like Piglet would sit alongside those really nicely. I could imagine it being on her roster. So I emailed her. I finished editing in November, and I thought, no one wants to receive a submission in December, so I'm going to email in January. And by the end of January, we had met and decided to work together. So that was just like a dream, because you know when you're really keen to work with someone, you're just like, just be cool, don't stare at them too intently, just be cool. So I was thrilled about that.
I mean, my interview to be a bookseller, I was like, don't be too much.
Yeah, the mantra that's just constantly going through my head. And then we worked together. Harriet is a really excellent editor, so we worked on tightening up the manuscript together for I was kind of dithering around and trying to do my thesis at the same time, so it took us a little while, but we were ready to submit in October. And then quite quickly after that, I signed with Doubleday in the UK and then Henry Holt in the US. And that was just like a whirlwind of a time. It all came together. But which was fascinating, because on submission, there were some publishers that were like, oh, would you consider changing the end so we know what happens? And then the publishers that didn't ask that and that really got the book, I was like, yes, it has to be one of these people, because these people are they understand
they
my intent. But that was fascinating.
Yeah, that question is like, no, you don't get it. You don't get the book.
Yeah. But it's so interesting to receive, because I can totally understand it, because when you're thinking, like, you both know, like, for publishing, like, when you're thinking commercially, like, if this had been a different book, it would have possibly a greater reach. I understand the desire to change it, but I'm so grateful that there are publishers that are interested in the same kind of experiments that I am.
Oh, how wonderful. So was that October 2022 that the book...
Yes. I actually, when Doubleday acquired, I just finished my thesis, because we'd gone to Crete just to like lie down and eat halloumi for a week. And then I had the meetings to acquire the book whilst I was there. So I was like, this feels like a life that is not my own, but what a time.
I love hearing these stories. It's always like so chaotic and busy and everything. It's amazing.
Yeah. Also such a juxtaposition from the life of just like a very hunched over desk life, just on my own.
And I guess too, like, ahead of the book coming out, because it came out so early in the year, it was really being talked about, you know, as one of the must-read books for 2024. And, I mean, we totally agree. But I'm just curious, how did that impact you, you know, as a debut author, to sort of have that sort of talk and be seeing that around, you know, before it's come out? What was that experience like?
It's very bizarre. I think I was helped a lot by the ability to dissociate. I feel like even now it feels like this is a very nice thing to be happening to someone, as if that person wasn't me. So it all felt very surreal and odd, and perhaps maybe publishing math will help me. Maybe in 2 years I shall be able to feel all the sensations, but right now it just feels like, well, I don't know.
It is funny. I think people often say that it just, like, none of it feels real until they actually see the book in bookshops maybe like 3 times. Like, the first time you're like, oh, they've just put that there because I'm here or something.
Yes,
but once you actually sort of just normal, once you sort of see it like in your normal life, it's like, oh, that really does feel real now. Like,
yes.
I worked with an author last year who brought her teenage sons to one of her book events, and she was like, they need to understand that it's real. And I was like, yeah, they do. This is a big deal.
Yes, it's very weird. I think the weirdest thing has been people that I know reading it and asking me questions. And then me being both myself, like my personal self and my author self at the same time, and being like, oh wow, these two personhoods are colliding. What an odd experience, but lovely.
It's all very strange. Mm. And then to maybe bring another version of yourself in for the very end of this chat, you're a board game designer. Can we just talk about that for a minute?
Yes. Yeah, I was actually just thinking as you were asking, because I've seen our games, like some of them are in Waterstone, so I'd already had that weird thing of being like, of seeing it on a shelf. So I guess for the book, I'd already been kind of primed for what that might feel like. But yes.
Yeah, I guess it would be the same, wouldn't it? Something you made.
What are some of the games? I'm curious now.
So our big one is called Dog Park, which is about walking dogs, which you may not be surprised as my spaniel has just been walking back and behind my chair, just like pacing the room. And our second one's called Forever Home, which is about rescuing dogs. And next we plan to do a game that's not about dogs. So,
they sound so cute.
Yes, they are adorable.
Wow. How does one become a board game designer?
It was something that my husband and I had wanted to, we had always enjoyed playing board games together, and he is a brilliant business mind and like an excellent project manager, and my strengths are more in the creation and the kind of development of things, and so we tried to just combine those two things. Our first title, Dog Park, just really blew up, and we kind of just took it from there. Then we launched our business, so that is how. By two people who are just kind of nerding out.
I mean, I think most board game companies is probably the same thing, but...
Was it like a crowdfunding sort of thing?
Yeah. So Dog Park went to Kickstarter, which was our first title, and then has had a retail release and several reprints, and then Forever Home, which is our second one, we took directly to retail, which was exciting. But yeah, it's an interesting landscape where crowdfunding is really... like a really legitimate and interesting way to launch like bespoke and like luxury games, where they just wouldn't be suitable for like direct to retail offerings because the prices can get so high. But yes, it's a really interesting industry that is fun to be in, and we're currently in the stage of working on a new game, and to compare it to writing, in the development feels like iterative editing, so there's no shit draft, it's just shit and then trying to improve it a little bit to become less shit, and then onwards and onwards and onwards until hopefully at the end it's okay.
Yeah, I guess it probably is less, I imagine it would be less linear, because if the game doesn't, you know, work and it's like not playable, or, you know, I suppose it depends what type of game you might be making, but I feel like one day you know suddenly it's playable and it actually works, you know, with different rules and, depending on what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, one of our game designs, so we made a physical prototype for, and we started playing it, and we were like, this isn't a game. These are just, we're just doing, going through the motions of just doing. It wasn't fun. But yes, it's humbling. and immediately obvious when it doesn't work. Do you rope in friends? We do eventually. We get to the point where, because there's quite a lot of development, like we don't just do, like, we've had this idea, we see if it works. We do quite a lot of work before we get to that stage, because it can be very like, okay, like no one would ever buy or play this. This is terrible.
Yeah. Very awkward game night.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm curious, did you ever like make your own board games when you were a kid? Because I definitely made at least one, which was 100% just a Monopoly ripoff for some sort of school project that I had to make.
Yes. Yeah. I made one with my sister. And my husband's been making board games since he was, like, seven, just, like, various... He likes to gamify various things. So, yes, but I don't expect that they were any good. The one I made with my sister was, like, kind of like a... It was, like, a Trivial Pursuit, but based solely on each other. So it wouldn't be very good to commercialise, because it's, this game. But it was, like, a How Well Do You Know Me kind of style game.
Oh, that's fun. No, I don't think I ever made... like actually made little games or anything like that, not like physically at least anyway, but yeah, I'm big board game family, love playing board games with my family, like my sister and I,
they take it very seriously
with various groups of friends. Have we played Cluedo together, Michelle?
Yes, we played that Harry Potter one that I got you. Yeah, You're a little bit scary.
But yeah, no one likes to play Cluedo with my sister and I, or my aunts or my grandmother. Like, we have to, like, play with each other. Like, at Christmas, my gran was like, excellent, let's play Cluedo, because, like, we were actually all there. And, yeah, I think it was okay with, like, Michelle and, a little group of us we played. But one time with my more of my sister's friends, we tried to play Cluedo, and at the end, they were like, how did you figure it out? And me and Mickey had our, like, very complicated score sheets. And we were like, I know exactly what cards
you
all have.
Yeah, here's my whiteboard.
Like
very
that
much
thing
like
with
that,
all the
like that
red GIF string.
With the, like, murder board and string.
Yeah,
that's happening in our minds for sure. So
I kind of want to play Cluedo with you now. I feel like I need to see you in action.
Oh, it's I think it's very fun. It's absolutely my favorite board game.
Yeah,
Caitlin, I can't wait for you to visit and we can play board games, because Jack isn't like the biggest board game person, and there's this one, I don't know if you've played it, Lottie, called League of Lexicon, which I really want to play.
I really want to play but
I just feel like that is 100% not Jack's vibe, and so Caitlin, you will need to play it with me.
Yeah, this is the thing with games, you need people around you to play the games with.
Yeah,
that's true. Although Dog Park has a solo mode, so if you can't convince Jack, then
I think I might be able to get in with the dogs. Yeah, he will play a dog one. But yeah, it's hard also when there's just two of you. I love that. You know,
is cool.
Yeah, there is a pug card, so
there you go. He's sold on that. I was shelving kids' books the other day, and I was like, oh, this picture book has a pug on it. I would totally buy this. It's like, I can't wait to have a kid so I can buy them pug picture books. What a lovely note to end on. So Piglet is available now in the UK, in Australia, and in the US. So if our discussion about food has not convinced you enough already, please go read this book. It's brilliant. Make sure you tell us what you're eating while you're reading this book as well. Where can people find and follow you online, Lottie?
I'm on Instagram at LD Hazel. I'm also on Twitter, but I can't call X, sporadically. Should you like to sporadically follow me over there?
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Better Words. For even more recommendations, you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter on Substack at betterwords.substack.com.
We'd also love to continue the conversation on Instagram, where you can find us at BetterWordsPod.
You can also follow me, Caitlin, at Just a Bookish Babe.
And for more bookish discussions, find me, Michelle, on Substack at theunfinishedbookshelf.substack.com.
Just like with books, podcasts like ours rely on word-of-mouth recommendations.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a book-loving friend and leave a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it.